Today I'm going to break down one of the biggest government scandals in the entire history of the 21st century through the lens of breaking down the deceptive framing devices used by the Washington Post this week to try to stop the scandal's public exposure. What I've done here is I've highlighted this whole article, and every one of these highlights is going to elucidate a deeper aspect of the scandal. This is intended to be a deep dive analysis for those who are totally new here and you just want a primer on the whole thing, which is essentially the story of how hundreds of millions of social media posts across Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, Reddit, every single platform on the American internet was censored ahead of the 2020 elections, during the 2022 midterm elections, and during the entire COVID-19 pandemic. This is essentially the story of how the government, the private sector, civil society, and news media and fact-checking orgs fused into the cell of a single atom, essentially, to form what was called their whole-of-society response to censoring the internet.
Addressing disinformation requires a whole-of-society approach.
Countering disinformation, we often talk about a whole-of-society response.
From a CISA standpoint, and we hear this term all the time, a problem like disinformation and fighting disinformation really requires a whole-of-society response. And I know whole-of-society is a little bit cliche and a term that gets thrown around a lot.
I think the solution has to be whole-of-society, which is a word that we throw around a lot, especially in venues like these, right? We need cooperation from the tech platforms. But we also need people in the government who are willing to say, yes, this is a problem, and it's not just about foreign actors.
This is going to be a pretty advanced talk aimed to educate policymakers and investigators who have a certain baseline background in this. If you're new and you want the world's best primer on it, simply go to this primer at Foundation for Freedom Online. It breaks down the entire thing, the networks, the funding, the scale and scope of the censorship that was done, who all was involved, why they did it, their confession videos essentially on tape. You will walk away from this with a PhD in the scandal. But I'm going to use this lecture for a deep dive. But again, if you want it linearly, simply go right here. So the Washington Post reached out to me this week telling me that they were going to be running this piece, and I had a conversation with Gabe Kaminsky from the Washington Examiner about my expectations. I told Gabe ahead of time that the piece would be indistinguishable from a ChatGPT auto-aggregation of all of the press releases of the federal government and EIP, simply taking their word for what they say without any interrogation of the mountains of underlying evidence, confession videos, source documents. I told Gabe that the article is going to deflect by using words like researcher and study instead of using the word censorship or flagging. It's going to try to characterize them as nebbish professors rather than as government-partnered operatives. And it is probably going to even include, and I said this directly, and you can ask Gabe, I said it's probably also going to have a picture of one of the stars of the story, like Alex Stamos or Renee DiResta or Kate Starbird, and it's going to have soft lighting, and it's going to be middle distance, and the person is going to be looking slightly away from the camera in a kind of angelic, mysterious hue to really drive home the mystery. I said they'll probably even send out a photo team to do it. And as you can see, it turns out they actually used a picture from March for this, but it feels like that scene from 8 Mile where, Eminem sort of says what the other guy is going to rap about before it comes out. I called each and every aspect of this, and you're going to find out now why this was so predictable and how and what a mistake they made by bringing this to me. So let's now tell this story through the lens of cutting through the deceptive framing devices that the Washington Post uses here. We'll start with the title. These academics studied falsehoods spread by Trump. Now the GOP wants answers. Let's start with the word academics. This is a word used to mislead you. These are not academics. These are government cutouts. I'm going to say that again. These are not academics, certainly not in any classical sense that matches any definition that you probably associate with an academic. These are government cutouts. They are self-aware that they are government cutouts. The government itself is self-aware that the universities are government cutouts. In fact, the head of EIP, the Election Integrity Partnership, the head of the 120-person censorship consortium, partnered with the Department of Homeland Security, even described his university department and EIP writ large as a government cutout.
There was a lack of capability around election disinformation. This is not because CISA didn't care about disinformation, but at the time, they lacked both kind of the funding and the legal authorizations to go do the kinds of work that would be necessary to truly understand how election disinformation was operating. So because of the feedback and the ideas from this group, we were able to pull together pretty quickly a project between these four different institutions to try to fill the gap of the things that the government cannot do themselves. CISA lacked the legal authorizations, so we were able to pull together a project to try to fill the gap of the things that the government cannot do themselves.
So understand what he just said right there. This is Alex Stamos, the head of Stanford University's censorship lab, the Stanford Internet Observatory, the head of the entire EIP consortium with Stanford, UW, Graphica, and the Atlanta Council, saying that CISA, the censorship subagency within DHS, wanted to do this counter-misinformation work, which, as you will see, is just straight-up censorship work. That's it. It's not research. It's mass flagging and programming the algorithms to tune you out of existence. And he is saying the federal government, CISA, wanted to do this, expressed an interest in doing this, but they knew that it was illegal. They lacked the legal authorizations. And so EIP was set up to fill the gaps of what the government could not do itself. This is what is called a government cutout. When the government wants to do something, but doesn't want to be seen doing it, it launders or outsources to a non-governmental private sector or civil society institution working closely behind the scenes with the government so that technically, even though it's government sourced and government sought, the fingerprints are on an entity at the plausible, deniable level at a non-governmental way. This is stuff the CIA does. When the State Department wants to carry out a deniable operation, doesn't want the U.S. government's fingerprints on something, the CIA will carry it out, and it will work through a series of cutout organizations that don't look like their government. They will work with private firms, and they will work with universities to launder the operation to remove the fingerprints. But here you have the head of EIP giving up the game, saying they only set it up because the government told them they couldn't do it. They were expressly set up as a cutout. The whole premise of using a word like academic is to present the academics as if they are independent, totally independent from the government, removed, making up their own minds, a firewall between them and the government. And yet not only were they partnered, and as we will see, using government-funded domestic disinformation switchboards to mass flag your posts, they were a birth child of the federal government. They asked the government for permission to exist. This is page 21 of EIP's 292-page tell-all report, in which they bragged about everything they did and got rewarded by the Biden administration with a joint $3 million government grant to do more censorship for the 2022 midterms and the 2024 election. They also sell this censorship structuring instruction manual to other universities. What you see on page 21 here is EIP's operational timeline, their self-described operational timeline. You'll see on June 9th, 2020, this is 4 months before the election, before election day of the last presidential election, EIP had a meeting with CISA to present EIP concept. So this is EIP, Alex Stamos, meeting with the government to present to the government their proposed solution for filling the gaps of what the government wanted to censor but could not do itself. You can't get more government cutout than that. Actually, you can. These are screenshots, citations in the FFO report, showing that every single entity in the Election Integrity Partnership, all four of them, Stanford, UW, Grafka, and the Atlanta Council, all are funded by the federal government. Grafka got about $7 million in Pentagon grants. The Atlanta Council gets funds from the Department of State, Department of Defense, Department of Energy, the National Endowment for Democracy, USAID. And Stanford and UW, just months after the 2020 election that they censored, and 100% of their targets were the opposition to the Biden administration, the Biden administration magically gave them $3 million of your taxpayer funding to upscale them for censoring the 2022 midterms in 2024. That's a 5-year grant, $3 million for Alex Stamos and the rest and Kate Starbird's groups. They asked for permission to exist. They, quote, presented the concept to CISA. The government told them that the government couldn't do it, so they need to exist to fill the government's gaps. They're all funded by the government, but wait, there's more. They're also a complete revolving door with government. Here you'll see that the head of CISA, Chris Krebs, in 2020, right after he left government, the first thing he did was he started a two-man consultancy firm with the head of EIP, Alex Stamos. The head of the government side of the censorship and the head of the private sector side of the censorship literally went into business together the moment the government guy got kicked out of government. So the head of CISA gets in bed with Stanford University's Alex Stamos. How about the top deputy at CISA, Matt Masterson? What did he do when he left government? Well, he also went to Alex Stamos's Stanford University, Stanford Airnet Observatory as a fellow right after leaving government. The top two guys rotated directly into the exact cutout that they had set up while in government. Alex Stamos, and it runs in reverse. It's not just the government with a revolving door to the universities. From the university side, Alex Stamos spent 2021 and 2022 directly on CISA's Cyber Hygiene Advisor Subcommittee. Renee DiResta gives lectures, as we will see, at CISA disinformation summits. Kate Starbird, who is the head of EIP's University of Washington unit, headed the Mis- and Disinformation Subcommittee at CISA. So they're currently concurrently occupying these government advisory posts in addition to being funded by the government, coordinating with the government, being born out of the government, and rotating back and forth, totally indistinguishable. And in fact, the whole society model is for them to be in lockstep. So understand, when you see this word academic, 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 they are saying this to throw you off. They are saying this so that you don't see the word government, and so you don't see the word political operative. Through the academic institutions, they are raising a censorship mercenary army. As FFO has documented, $40 million have flowed from the Biden administration straight to 40 different universities they have raised as a censorship mercenary army to do the same thing that Alex Stamos and Stanford and Kate Starbird and UW did in 2020. They want it to control every sensitive policy issue, and were only stopped because of political pushback in late 2022. Alex Stamos is not an academic. Alex Stamos got a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering and computer science. No PhD, no teaching history, didn't come up through the system like an academic. He runs what's known as a center, where he spearheads the university staff that does the censorship work. He is a political operative, and that center is simply used as a perch, a non-governmental perch, for government-coordinated operations that the government itself couldn't get caught doing because it would be illegal if the government did it. So they launder it to Alex Stamos's university center, where the operative coordinating with the government can fill the gaps of what the government can't do itself. Now let's look at the next deceptive framing trick, the word studied. Now this is a big one. Just as the word academics is used, so you don't see the word government cutout, the word studied is used, so you don't see the word censored. Now understand what they're trying to do here. They are trying to both indirectly suggest, and in a sense directly say, that they did not directly involve themselves in censorship, they simply studied misinformation. This would be like a nuclear physicist saying, we worked in the Manhattan Project as research scientists. We didn't actually drop the bombs out of the plane. They did both. They were, in a sense, not just the research scientists of the atom bomb. They were the battle planners of the war, and they personally drove the planes to drop them over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, so to speak. And I'm going to show you how they did this. So we're going to start with a little game where I will play evidence, and you will ask yourself, is this EIP studying something or EIP censoring something? Is this EIP passively research something, or is this EIP actively flagging, actively pressuring, actively coercing, actively demanding, actively jawboning the tech companies to tear down information, and what information to tear down, when, what, why, who, all the way down to graphs of highly specific individuals and tens of millions of posts in the aggregate. This interview is dated August 26, 2020. EIP's first day of activity was the very next week, September 3rd, right after this interview. And you will hear Alex Stamos describe how he lined up the tech companies in order to get them to take stuff down. Not to assist in the research, to take stuff down.
So we have reached out and we have had two-way conversations with all the major platforms, right? So we've had really good conversations with Facebook, Twitter, Google, Reddit. We've talked to TikTok. That's actually been very productive. Some of the smaller groups, Discord. There's a bunch of companies that didn't really exist or they were much smaller in 2016 and are now real players. So that's been good. I think, our goal with that is that if we're able to find disinformation, that we'll be able to report it quickly and then collaborate with them on taking it down. And there's a good precedent for this, which all four of these organizations have worked on research projects side by side with tech platforms.
Oh, so they're using their research relationship to then, I'm sorry, what was that? What did you say that? Say that again?
And that we'll be able to report it quickly. If we're able to find disinformation, that we'll be able to report it quickly and then collaborate with them on taking it down. And there's
taking it down. So, again, look at our operational timeline. EIP, Alex Stamos, had a meeting with the government, the federal government, CISA, to present the concept of an outside censorship consortium. They're saying it was to study misinformation, but the studying was only the first step. After the studying came the taking it down part. And in fact, he actively colluded with every single tech platform ahead of time. Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, TikTok, Reddit, even the small ones, to line them up so that Alex Stamos and his 120 staffers could report it quickly and take it down the moment EIP went live with the federal government, which was September 3rd, 2020, the very week after that interview. So in that intervening period between when he cooked up the idea with the federal government and when the censorship consortium went live is when he was lining up all of the tech platforms so that they would be in a position to quickly censor the information Stamos flagged. Now, I'm focusing on Alex Stamos here because he is the head of EIP. He's also the head of Stanford University. And he's also the one who had the closest relationship, the two-man consultancy, just him and the head of the very federal government agency they partnered with for censorship. But Alex Stamos had 120 people, a huge teams, gigantic teams is how they described.
You're seeing five of us right now, but again, there's like 120 people who worked on this. I want to make sure all the people in the audience understand that there's huge teams behind each of us.
Gigantic teams.
gigantic. Here in EIP's report on page 200 and all throughout the report is their description of nearly 5,000 individual posts, again, First Amendment protected posts, about your opinions about elections that EIP manually flagged, manually submitted in their tickets to the tech platforms to take stuff down. And you can see examples of the URLs, the First Amendment protected, totally benign, banal, always protected by Americans to be able to talk to each other about, is the issue that that they flagged in their own tickets for Sharpiegate. Here you see on the screen the censorship collusion screenshots included in their own report, where EIP submits a ticket to the tech platforms, all of them, TikTok, Facebook, Google, Twitter, as well as EIISAC, which I'll describe later, where Sharpiegate, they say, is trending on Twitter. They show a slew of URLs to take down or to action under remove, reduce, inform, which is just censoring by banning it, censoring it by adding friction so it's de-amplified, or censoring it through a fact-check label. It's all censorship. It's all intended to de-amplify, to take the stuff down, or to stop it from going viral. An EIP member says, "Hello, platform partners. We've added you on several different cases of claims which are going viral right now." So they are actively organizing every tech platform on Earth in the United States so that they can all collectively take down viral claims being made by U.S. citizens protected by the First Amendment. And on top of that, they rally them to do a counter-narrative. This is as active censorship and as active political engineering as you can possibly get. And not only that, they had the audacity to redact the government partners. These are government communications. These are communications with government officials. All of this is a violation of the National Records Act. Why aren't these tickets discoverable through FOIA? Why is Stanford holding them rather than the government partners? There should never be a government partner name redacted unless something's classified. And as you'll see, there's a damn good reason why they're trying to not disclose these tickets, because it's where the bodies are buried in the censorship industry. But we'll get to that. Now we get to the big whopper. We've already established it's not studying. It was active flagging for takedown. It was active collusion with the federal government and the tech platforms themselves for takedown. It was a government cutout doing the taking down. But how do you get to the scale of hundreds of millions of social media posts? This was introduced through a incredibly devious trick called delegitimization. Delegitimization was the brainchild of EIP to coerce the tech platforms, exploiting their fears of being punished by Washington allies of EIP, exploiting their fear of huge regulatory pressure and crisis PR communications from bad press, to get them to add a terms of service violation policy called delegitimization that banned all questions about the legitimacy of election processes, outcomes, or election integrity issues, including and especially mail-in ballots. Tens of millions of social media posts about mail-in ballots alone were all banned in the United States of America because a government cutout, a monstrosity born out of the Department of Homeland Security and EIP, bragged that they were responsible for the tech companies adopting this vast terms of service policy change that instantaneously made tens of millions of posts a bannable offense, a bannable speech police infraction.
I think EIP really helped push the envelope with things like just the notion that this delegitimization of electoral processes that we were seeing in the summer and early fall, that this should be against content moderation policies on these platforms.
So you just heard him say that it was EIP who got the tech companies to push the envelope to adopt delegitimization as a terms of service policy, delegitimization of mail-in ballots, delegitimization of early voting drop boxes, articulating any of the legal challenges in the courts. agreeing with one of the candidates in the race in the election. And it was EIP who got them to take the proactive steps to enforce the policy that they jawboned them, as we will see, to adopt.
And they began to take proactive steps there. We did get industry partners to push the envelope a little bit in the U.S. context. But how can a similar kind of pressure and responsiveness be elicited from platforms when it's not a U.S. election with huge regulatory stakes for these companies?
We did get industry partners, meaning the tech platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Google, YouTube, TikTok, Snapchat, Reddit, to adopt this terms of service policy change, this censorship policy, this speech restriction policy, things you cannot talk about in America online anymore. And what he says is, we got them to do it because there were, quote, huge regulatory stakes for them if they didn't. And they're worried that they won't have the same influence over the tech platforms when they can't command that kind of pressure on the companies on the regulatory side, meaning congressional allies like Senator Mark Warner or Amy Klobuchar or Elizabeth Warren, who are all threatening to break up the tech companies if action wasn't taken, or to regulate them through the FTC out of profitability. And now you're going to hear Alex Damos articulate the two-step plan by which you get tens of millions of social media posts removed, reduced, or informed across all of these platforms. Here is the Stamos two-step.
My suggestion is, if people want to get the platforms to do stuff, is first you've got to push for written policies. And so this is something we started in the summer, in August, is, as Kate talked about, Carly Miller led a team from all four institutions to look at the detailed policies of the big platforms and to measure them against situations that we expected to happen. Now, we're not going to take credit for all the changes they made, but we had to update this thing like 8 or 9 times, right? And so, like, putting these people in a grid to say, you're not handling this, you're not handling this, not handling this, creates a lot of pressure inside the companies and forces them to kind of grapple with these issues, because you want specific policies that you can hold them accountable for. The second is, when you report stuff to them, report how it's violating those written policies, right? So there's two steps here. Get good policies, and then say, this is how it's violating it. We will have our statistics, right? But I think we were pretty effective in getting them to act on things that they hadn't acted on before.
They were effective at getting the tech platforms to censor content that they didn't censor before. And they did it through two steps. They used the threat of regulatory action by the government combined with crisis PR to generate pressure for the companies if they were shown censorship policies adopted by their peers and made to look like they were a platform for misinformation, which in their words created huge pressure inside the companies. And you'll notice how Stamos very carefully tries to hedge by talking about things and stuff rather than saying the word censor.
We're not going to take credit for all the changes they made.
He's saying we're not going to take credit for all of them because he knows that they have to have some semblance of independence. But he's taking credit for some of them. This is the government. This is the government's hand-picked partner and hand-selected cutout, also funded by the government, also doing this censorship through government-funded technology through the domestic disinformation switchboard.
But we had to update this thing like 8 or 9 times.
What he's referring to is the grid they created for all of the platform policies of every single tech platform, and then pressuring every single one of them to say, Facebook is censoring mail-in ballots. Why aren't you? Why aren't you? You know, there's going to be bad PR for you if you, Twitter, are not in line with best practices on stopping misinformation. And then the hit pieces come, as they did, and one by one, all of them folded. And they articulate this as being the effective plan. And these people had the chutzpah to call all of that studying. By EIP's own math, this is page 201 of their own report, EIP classified 22 million tweets in just the 2020 election cycle alone as being misinformation terms of service violations, i.e., censorable under the very terms of service policy they jawboned the companies to adopt when they didn't want to adopt them and wouldn't have done otherwise. And they bragged about this on tape. Now, when Foundation for Freedom Online broke this 22 million tweet figure, EIP responded in a panic, trying to argue that these 22 million tweets they identified as misinformation, they identified them after the election, don't you know? So it's 22 million, yeah, but that's not what we flagged. That was what we assessed after the election. This is extremely devious on their part. An outrageous limited hangout they're trying to pull here. Those 22 million tweets were made before the election, or before all the processes to challenge election results that were still being processed in the courts. That is, all of these tweets were made between the summer of 2020 and December of 2020. So they were all during the election cycle, these 22 million. And wouldn't you know, the very first day that EIP formally began operations, remember, they started all the way back in June, they were doing concept presentation meetings to CISA then, but the very first day they formally set up shop was the very day that Facebook changed its terms of service to ban delegitimization, meaning anybody who delegitimizes the validity of mail-in ballots, early voting drop boxes, or any of the voting procedures that were still being litigated in the state assemblies, anyone who delegitimized them, that's tens of millions of Americans no longer able to talk about mail-in ballots because a government cutout, a government-partnered censorship consortium, expressly set up because the government wasn't allowed to do it itself, jawboned Facebook to adopt that policy. And the very following week, September 10th, Twitter did as well. So those 22 million tweets that were terms of service violations as misinformation, meaning censored under the delegitimization policy, that delegitimization policy was only put in place in Twitter because of EIP, and it was done so on September 10th, which meant those 22 million tweets were all bannable only because EIP stepped in to jawbone them for the entire election cycle. So that's 22 million tweets that EIP targeted for takedown. Case closed. And then remember, you have to add in all of these platforms. That's 22 million just on Twitter alone. Facebook, Pinterest, also September 3rd, first day of EIP operations. Snapchat, TikTok, YouTube, Nextdoor, everyone folded to EIP and the powerful network of congressional allies and major national security figures behind them. And that's why you couldn't talk about the last election. And as we'll see, it's also why you couldn't talk about the many aspects of the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, another trick that EIP used was to distinguish between incidents and narratives. Misinformation incidents, meaning individual posts, and misinformation narratives, which can comprise millions of posts. You'll see here these misinformation narratives that they identify. Everything from the Dominion voting machines to the entire Stop the Steal concept or movement, Sharpiegate, narratives around poll watcher issues, the Postal Service, dead voter rolls, Antifa and the Sunrise Zoom calls. And you'll see here EIP attaches in their own internal documents the approximate number of tweets related to the misinformation narratives, that is, the banned narratives. Some of these have millions or hundreds of thousands, 7 million, 3 million, 800,000, 600,000. These are all automatically downranked under remove, reduce, inform, and they were tickets for all of these, and they're refusing to turn them over. These are tickets that combine the federal government, EIP, and every single tech platform on Earth, or at least in America, all plotting to ban you from talking about dozens of narratives and 66 discrete narratives for COVID, according to their own document. When they lie straight to your face and tell you they only censored things having to do with time, place, and manner of voting.
We had a narrowly tailored scope focused on false and misleading narratives specific to voting.
Ask them what the Sunrise Zoom calls, the Antifa phone calls, are doing on this censored list, with hundreds of thousands of misinformation tagged posts there. Or how they censored the color revolution concerns articulated by Darren Beatty's Revolver, which is also referenced as a misinformation narrative in EIP's report. You see, one trick that EIP plays is when they deem something to be a misinformation narrative, they no longer need to argue that each individual post, each individual tweet, is a terms of service violation. If the misinformation narrative is declared banned, then it doesn't matter whether you are right or wrong. If it's malinformation, even if you're right, you are still advancing a narrative that is deemed wrong. It is the great catch-all they used to ban, as we'll see, 66 discrete narratives covering everything from vaccines to masks to the efficacy of lockdown policies for the COVID-19 pandemic. This is building to be the blueprint for every sensitive policy issue in our democracy. But I'm not weighing in on the substance of any of these narratives. I don't know whether any of these are right or wrong. I don't make a substantive point on these. It's about freedom of speech and freedom on the internet. Never before in American history have people been banned from being able to talk about an ongoing election, especially with that banning coming straight from the Department of Homeland Security through a deliberately constructed cutout to disguise the U.S. government's leadership role. Now, we've only covered the tip of the iceberg here, but for brevity's sake, I'll pause the lecture here and we'll continue with another round tomorrow.